The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin Standard Podcast Seminar. In today's seminar, we're going to be discussing the concept of the stock to flow, which is something that I discussed in the Bitcoin Standard. And it's become a pretty popular topic amongst Bitcoiners over the last couple of years because it seems to have proven to be a good analytic lens to analyzing the economics of Bitcoin, digital currencies, and other currencies as well. So briefly, stock to flow as a ratio is a measure of the total stockpiles of a good divided by the flow or the annual production of the good. So it gives us a sense of the orders of magnitudes involved between the total supply of a good that we have that exists in the market and the annual production of this good that is being added onto the market. Effectively, what it is, it's just the inverse of the percentage growth rate. So if you have something whose stockpile is growing at 5% per year, the stock to flow is going to be 1/5 or 20, or 1/0.05, so 20. So the stock to flow is just the inverse of the annual supply growth rate. And of course, as you can imagine intuitively, this would make sense. The annual supply growth rate is likely to mean more devaluation of the currency. And so if you look at national currencies, and I do that in the Bitcoin standard, if you look at national currencies, you see the harder national currencies, the ones that have maintained their value better over time, are the ones that have a supply growth rate ranging around 5, 6, 7, 8, 9%, or, well, a little less, but about 5, 7% more or less, but in the low percentages. Whereas the bad currencies that have had very high inflation and hyperinflation have had their supply growth rate grow at 100, 200, 300, sometimes in the thousands of percent per year. So obviously, intuitively, this makes sense. If your currency is growing at a percentage supply growth rate of 1,000%, which happens in some places at some point in time, you'll witness very quick devaluation of the value of the currency. And so you're going to witness very high price inflation. And you're going to witness the amount of wealth that is parked in the currency decline, because nobody wants to be holding a currency that is being inflated at this rate. So an annual percent growth rate of 1,000 is a stock to flow ratio of 0.1. Any good with a stock to flow ratio of 0.1 is not going to work as a good money. Nobody is going to hold it, and so it's going to drop. For most market commodities, the stock to flow is in the range of one. It's roughly around one. In other words, if you look at how much copper we have in stockpiles in the market, held in reserves and held by copper traders and being stored by copper consumers, if you look at how much of that exists around the world, it's roughly in the range of 1 year's production. And when I say roughly in the range of 1 year's production, it could be 50% less, it could be 50% more, depending on the dynamics of the market and the dynamics of the metal itself. But more or less, every year, we're making about as much as the stockpiles that we have at any given point in time, because people aren't keeping the stockpiles around. Nobody likes to keep large amounts of copper sitting around. If they have them, they're just holding them temporarily until they can ship them on. So for most market commodities, the stock to flow ratio is around one. It may vary, but it's not going to vary very much. For monetary commodities, for commodities that develop a monetary role, you're going to see a stock to flow ratio that is closer to, that rises above one. And so the higher it rises, the more likely it is to have a monetary role, the more likely it is to be used as money, and the more likely it is to store value for the future. And so we see this across metals. The only metals which have a stock to flow significantly different than one are silver and gold. That's it. Silver and gold are the only metals whose stock to flow is significantly different than one. Historically, it used to be that silver's stock to flow was around 20, 30, something like that. In other words, you had somewhere between 3 to 5% annual growth in the stockpile of silver. But over the last century and a half, as I like to discuss in the Bitcoin standard, over the last century and a half, we see that the price of silver has gone down drastically. And so the value of silver has, the value of silver on the market has declined. And with that, we see, and I'm going to share here the chart of the price of silver. If you look at the chart for the price of silver over this period, we've seen the price of silver go from the period from 1870, really, is when the silver dump started, and it has never abated. So this is the actual spreadsheet that I used for the Bitcoin standard. This is the chart there, and this is these are the numbers for it. You see, historically, in the 1600s and 1700s, we were at around 15, and it was always around 15, sometimes dipping to 14, but usually 15, and in the 1800s, it starts rising to 16. And that's when, you know, the canary was singing in the gold mine of silver, in the mine for silver, in the silver mine, not the gold mine. It's really around 1871, 1875, really, when the real decline in the value of silver begins. It rises to 17 for the first time in 1875, and then 18 in 1876. And then it takes off into the 20s and 30s and continues to increase. It has periods where it drops back down to the early 20s, but generally the trend is for number to go up. And this is up until 2016. It was at 73. Today, I think the gold-silver ratio is closer to one. It did hit 120 since the publication of the Bitcoin standard at some point, but I think now it's closer to 100. Silver has been in a bear market compared to gold for 150 years, and that's not about to change anytime soon. And with this, what we see is that silver's actual stock-to-flow ratio has been declining along with it. And so if we look at the chart for the stock-to-flow, this chart I had in the Bitcoin standard, but I did not include the data. I did not include a table. I thought the chart was enough, but I should have probably included the table with the data. This shows us the stock to flow for all these different metals. For copper, it's close to zero. I don't know why this is not my usual world computer, so now it's rounding the numbers down. But it was close to zero on for copper. It's about one for oil. At that time, it was 5.6 for silver. I remember the stock to flow for silver around then was around 5.6. If you measured the global silver stockpiles and divided them by annual silver production, it was around 5.6. For the euro, it was 16. For the US dollar, it was 18. And for the Swiss franc, it was around 22. This was the average for the previous 25 years. This was the 25-year average that I took for these currencies. So it wasn't a projection. And it wasn't 1 year, it was the average for the past 25. That's really the best estimate we can get for fiat currencies, since they're not algorithmic. And then if you look at the Japanese yen, it's at 25. It does better than most fiat currencies. It has a low stock to flow ratio. And then gold was at 63. So Bitcoin in 2017, when I was writing the book, Bitcoin was at 25 at that time. But in 2025, Bitcoin is going to jump to 125. Now Bitcoin is around 50, 56 or so, depending on how you calculate it, how you calculate the stock to flow. But Bitcoin stock to flow now is around 50, 56. And in 2025, after the next halving, it's going to be around 125, which is going to be the highest stock to flow that has ever happened. Gold, we're not going to overtake gold most likely in this cycle. There have been times in which gold has had a higher stock to flow than Bitcoin right now. But by the next cycle, when the stock to flow rises to 125, Bitcoin is going to be higher than any monetary asset that humanity has ever seen. At that point, it really overtakes all other assets. We've never had a monetary asset that had an annual growth rate that was less than 1%. It's going to be wild. I cannot wait for this. This is the situation with silver. And recently, I thought, you know, what inspired this discussion for today was the recent discussion that you start hearing about of people looking to pump all kinds of stupid shitcoins, thinking that, you know, if we all buy them together, then somehow we can all get rich together. And it's, I thought it would be a good time to do this. I made a thread about silver, and I basically explained why I think silver is a shitcoin. And this is a good example of it. It's down to around 5.6 right now, the stock to flow, and it continues to decline. And arguably since then, since the book has been published, I was looking at the most recent numbers from the Silver Institute. It's actually worse than that. It's now down to 3. So the stock to flow for silver is practically 3 at this point. And I think there is a good article, which I'm going to, if we look at, this is the data from the Silver Institute. If you look at it, there's the Silver Report, which runs the data, but it's not very, they have the data for the stockpiles in this. This is where I got data. And if you do it this year, you'll find that the stock to flow, they don't calculate it in the report, but if you do it, you'll find that the stock to flow is 3. Now, there was an article by a guy called Jan Nieuwenhuis from a company called Voima Gold, where he takes issue with the Silver Institute's numbers on silver. And argues that the stock to flow should be for silver should be between 30 and 60 rather than 3. And so I thought this would be worth bringing up and looking at. It's a good overview of the numbers. And I recommend reading this article in full, seeing his argument. But ultimately, based on the Silver Institute, he comes up with this chart for what is the supply of silver, above ground silver. And so if you look at the, here we have a pie chart where almost 50% of the pie chart is industrial use, undetermined or lost silver. This is about 852,000 tons. So a little less than 50%. And then another chunk, which is a little bit smaller, but also less than 50%, 791,000 tons. That's for jewelry, decorative, and religious purposes. And then you've got $51,000 of coins and 57,000 coins of bullion. So if you look at an annual production for silver every year is around 30,000 tons. So what the Silver Institute numbers would imply is if you wanted to look at global stockpiles, you look at coins and bullion, because that's what's liquid. That's the liquid silver. That's the silver that's really playing a monetary role. And so you would divide 30, roughly 30,000 tons by 108, which is the total for bullion and coins, and you would get a stock to flow ratio of about 3. Now, this article takes issue with this and says, no, you should count all of these 791,000, which is jewelry, decorative, and religious silver. You should count that as part of the silver stockpile. And so if you count that, then now the global silver stockpile is around 891 or about 900,000. It's around 900,000 tons. And so then 30,000 divided by 900,000 is closer to a stock to flow ratio of 30. So as he says, I would suggest it's somewhere between 30 and 60. If you take all bullion, coins, jewelry, and silverware, you will arrive at 30. If you add the silver in industrial products, you will arrive at 60. So what do we make of that? Do we agree with Mr. Jan Nieuwenhuis on this analysis? Do we think that this means that silver should have a stock to flow of 30 or 60?
Yeah, I mean, what you said about bullion and coins being the thing that's playing a monetary role, then that would make more sense. I mean, maybe you'd have a case for jewelry, decorative, and religious if the world went to shit, or if the price of silver just shot through the roof, then people might use jewelry as a form of money to get some fiat very quickly. But the industrial use, I don't see the case there too much, but there are my thoughts.
I think with the industrial, it's clearly out of the question. You can't really count the industrial because you know, the silver there is extremely expensive to take out. So it's effectively been buried under the ground. And now you need to mine it, and it's really expensive to mine it back. So there is some silver recycling that takes place always, and it does add to the supply. But you know, it has to be balanced with the cost of mining. We can't have too much recycling because, you know, if it's more expensive than the cost of mining, it's not going to happen. People will just mine it and they'll throw the silver away. And if it's much less expensive than mining, then it'll happen very quickly, and people will start converting the silver in massive quantities and inflate the market. So ultimately, the cost of recovering industrial silver or jewelry and decorative and religious silver, in my mind, is effectively makes them not part of the stockpile, because you can't really use silver stuff as money. And if you think about it with jewelry in particular, I think the reason you can't really count it is because it's not liquid. And in fact, when you're buying a jewelry piece made with silver, you're primarily paying for the production of the silver. You're not really paying for the stuff that's inside it. In other words, it's, you know, you look at the average piece of silver jewelry and all of the silver that's in it is worth a few dozen bucks in best case scenario. And usually the piece will sell at a significant markup to the content of silver inside it because there's craftsmanship that went into making it. In that sense, it's not being held as a monetary matter. It's that, you know, if it was with gold, it's this case is less clear because gold is far more valuable. You know, it's about 100 times more valuable per gram. So putting 10 grams of gold in a piece of jewelry is worth roughly 100 times as much as putting 10 grams of silver. But you can only fit so much silver or gold into a piece of jewelry. So ultimately, a necklace or a bracelet or a pendant or any kind of any kind of silver or gold jewelry will only carry so much monetary weight. In the case of gold, that can be significant. In the case of silver, it's just not. It's not as significant as the amount as the production that went into it. And so, effectively, selling a bracelet that has silver is, you know, it involves a significant cost because you're actually not just selling the silver that's inside it. You're losing the necklace. You're losing the craftsmanship that went into making the necklace or the bracelet. So you can't really count it as a monetary good, and you can't really count it as part of the stockpile. It's ultimately not part of the liquid market that is being bought and sold in a monetary sense. And for that, you should really look at bullion and coins. As I said, because gold is 100 times more valuable per gram, you can make the argument that this is different in the case of gold. But actually, when you think about it, this is also an indication of gold's growing demonetization. Because if you look at gold, and the data on gold is much better. If you look at gold, well, the data is obviously both terrible compared to Bitcoin data, but we're taking these numbers at face value. If you look at gold, there's about 92,000, almost half in jewelry. 33,000 is in official holdings by central banks. 38,000 is in bars and coins, 2,400 is in ETFs, and 27,000 is other fabrication and unaccounted. So the 27,000 are industrial uses. You could say that these are arguably outside of the stock to flow of the stockpile. You could make the argument that they aren't necessarily part of the stockpile. And with the jewelry as well, you could maybe argue that maybe some of that jewelry is becoming more about the cost of the jewelry itself, you know, the piece and the diamonds and the other things that go into it, and just the craftsmanship that went into it. That's what people are really paying for, rather than the gold content. And so, if you think about it this way, you could make the argument that gold has a higher stock to flow, has a lower stock to flow, because the stockpile is actually lower than it actually is. Because a lot of it is being stuck in industry and being stuck in jewelry where it's not very liquid, and it's not liquid as gold. You can't just take that piece of jewelry with a few grams of gold and expect to sell the gold. You have to find somebody who's going to be buying the jewelry and the, say, diamonds or rubies that come along with it. So the whole piece. So it's not really a liquid part of the market. It's not. You can't think about it as part of the stockpile, and you can't think about it as being held as part of the stockpile. Bringing it to market for its holders to be able to sell it, it's not liquid. It's not in bar and it's not in bullion. So you could arguably maybe say the same applies for gold. The stockpile for gold should be even lower. But in the case of silver, I think, you know, the proof is in the pudding. If you look at the history of the price of silver, you know, with all of these squeezes that they keep trying to do, we see how the price of silver just continues to plummet always. And so they tried to do the silver squeeze last week where they said, let's all buy silver. And then, you know, we'll spike silver and the banks will go bankrupt and we'll somehow, you know, we'll destroy Wall Street because we'll make them run out of an industrial metal. It's ridiculous because, you know, the production of silver can be ramped up very easily, and the recycling can be ramped up and you can bring significant stockpiles onto the market and depress the price. So there was a very quick pump from around 25 and a half to around 29, but they've crashed back down. It's entirely possible that they might get a short squeeze happening and that it would spike. We could see the price go up significantly. If you look at data, you know, it can go up, and particularly, you know, with when you measure it in national currencies, there is the possibility that it can continue to go up. If you look at the chart all years, you know, it's significantly up since 2000, significantly down since 1980, significantly up since 1940s, but not that significantly up since 1917. So it's really been a bear market for 100 years, more or less, for silver, even measured against the dollar. So today we're at 26, and back in 1917, it was at 18. So 18 to 26 is pretty abysmal. And that's even measured in dollars. So the notion that silver can significantly rise, I think, is ridiculous. And we see it happen over and over again. You know, we see these silver spikes in the 70s. There was a big spike. And then the Hunt brothers, the story that I discussed on the Bitcoin Standard, they spiked the price up significantly. Oh, yeah, this is adjusted for inflation. So you can ignore what I said about 1915. It was probably much cheaper in 1915. But this is adjusted for inflation. So yeah, it has gone up against the dollar, but it definitely has not gone up against gold. And so this is really why I think silver is a fool's game, because it's all of the disadvantages of gold without the only benefit. So you're getting, as if you look at this chart, you see that it's always basically falling against gold. It gets a few spikes where it rises. And this is the gold silver price ratio. So the higher the number, the more valuable gold is and the less valuable silver is. And so you see, it's just been a nonstop trend upward. Silver continues to devalue against gold. And this is, and you know, these are two commodities that are sold and bought all over the world. People buy and sell silver all over the world. It's easy to say manipulation, but ultimately you're talking about 150 years of people from all over the world mining gold and mining silver and buying gold and buying silver and selling gold and selling silver. And these prices have held through billions of transactions over a century and a half. And the trend is unmistakable. Silver is becoming worth less and less and less. And I think it's inevitably, it's both a cause and consequence of its constantly decreasing stock to flow ratio. So because it starts to lose monetary premium and it starts becoming less and less valuable as money, it becomes less valuable in terms of real goods and services. And so it becomes more economical to be used in things other than money. So you start seeing it in, you know, tea sets, and you start seeing it in industry showing up in all these places. And then that effectively means that you're eating away from the stockpile. So it becomes an industrial good in that it starts getting consumed. So once it starts to get consumed, you're eating from the stockpile. That's when the stock to flow begins to decline, because the production starts getting ramped up and the stockpile is being eaten down and the good is becoming an industrial good. And I wonder if we're seeing the same thing happen with gold now, because if you think about it in real terms, gold is probably not keeping up with inflation. Like, gold is still at 1800 right now. And, you know, we've seen an enormous amount of brr. Like, if you measure gold in terms of keeping up with value with other monetary assets, you know, it's barely keeping up with the US dollar. And the US dollar is massively getting inflated and losing value against hard assets at all times, as we see. So it's arguable that gold is becoming worth less and less as a part of the global economy. So the value of gold is declining because it's not growing as much, because it's not getting monetized as much, because people aren't moving to gold. People aren't moving to gold in very large quantities, and the supply of gold is increasing. And so arguably the price begins to decline in real terms, and that leads to more utilization in industry, and therefore that leads to stockpiles declining, and then that leads to a diminishing stock to flow ratio. That leads to the good becoming more of an industrial good and less of a monetary good. I think we're seeing this happen with silver right now. If you look at the numbers for this year, as we did now for silver, you see the stock to flow is closer to 3. So in the last 4 years since I was writing the book, I when I wrote the book, I think it was 2016 data. So from 2016 to 2020, we've had a decline in the stock to flow from 5.6 to about 3. So I wonder, 10 years from now, maybe silver stock to flow is closer to 1. And the price is, not significantly different from where it is right now. It could become an entirely industrial metal. And I can think of a similar scenario of why you could say the same about gold. I could see the same happening to gold. I can see the beginning of the process of demonetization gold happening because, let's face it, gold is not growing in value in a way that allows it to continue to be hoarded in large enough quantities to keep the stockpiles, the liquid stockpile, large enough to continue to be insignificant compared to the flow. And that's why I really think it would be, it could be that it would lose its monetary role. If it would happen, the point I'm trying to say is if it would happen, it would be because of declining demand, not increasing supply. And so this keeps getting being brought up. A lot of Bitcoiners like to make the point that gold is not going to work as money because, we're going to be mining asteroids. And when we mine asteroids, we're going to be bringing large quantities of gold into Earth, and then gold will become cheap. And this, I think, completely misses the point of why gold is money. It's not about it's not about the rarity of gold. It's about the stock to flow. It's not about how much gold there is or how much platinum or silver or dollars there is. It's about how much there is as a multiple of how much is being produced every year. In other words, it's about the stock to flow, not the absolute sizes of the stock and the flow. That's really the key. What would happen if we were to have a meteor or asteroid get mined for enormous quantities of gold? I guess we could imagine two scenarios. One scenario in which we just get a meteor hit the Earth and it has, say, 200,000 tons of gold. So as much gold as we have hits the Earth in one day. One giant rock falls on Earth and it's made entirely of gold. Or it has 200,000 tons of gold in it. Well, okay, so, and imagine we don't have... we have a very smooth distribution where one guy owns it and decides to keep selling it, minting it into bars and selling it on the market. So initially what's going to happen is that the minting of gold is going to bring the price down. But say he manages to sell all of his 200,000 tons of gold in a month or a year or whatever. And then what happens? Well, now we've run out of this new source of gold. And how much new gold is being produced? Still, the mines, the Earth's mines outside of this meteor are still producing the same quantity of gold that they were producing roughly before this meteor hit. And so roughly, the stock to flow is going to double, actually, because now we've doubled the stockpile because all of this new gold has come into the market. And now miners have less of an impact on the price. So once this is absorbed by the market, Then the next step is that gold just increased its monetary usefulness because its stockpile has become larger and its flow has remained relatively constant. And so the increase in the stockpile has led to an increase in the stock to flow. And so a couple of years down the line, gold ends up actually being a better money. But in reality, of course, we're not going to just get this one-time boost from heaven where we're going to be getting all this giant amount of gold being sold on the market. If you're going to think about it logically, first of all, we don't know how to mine asteroids other than in Hollywood movies. No matter what people like to say, it's not being done for a reason. It's completely... well, you know, I'm not going to say impossible or insane, but there are much cheaper ways of getting gold going onto an asteroid. It's a really, 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 really expensive, uncertain way. Like, there are much cheaper ways. Just dig deeper into a gold mine. It's far cheaper, far safer, far more reliable. And it's been done for thousands of years by humans. They know how to do it. So the notion that we can take an entire gold mining operation and stick it on an asteroid shooting through space and then take off with all the gold and bring it to Earth. I mean, I'm not going to say impossible. I'm just going to look at the economics of it. It's completely, and it's an entirely different level of expense to what we have right now, the methods that we have for mining gold. So if it were to happen, you know, if we were to discover this enormously cheap way of doing it, then the result is it's going to be also done roughly at the price of, you know, at the market price, more or less. And, you know, as it starts to scale, as it starts to increase, and as the production begins to increase, not much different happens other than the fact that more production comes onto the market, the stockpile increases, and then the new production continues to remain a small fraction of the total supply. In other words, what gives gold its monetary edge is the fact that the supply doesn't leak, the stockpile doesn't leak, the stockpile doesn't decline. So as long as you find more ways of producing gold, you're not going to demonetize it by finding more ways of producing gold. You're just going to dump it on the market and increase the stockpile and therefore lower the stock to flow. And it's kind of counterproductive because, you know, the more you produce, the more the stockpile. So then the more the quantity that you produce becomes a smaller fraction of the stockpile. So what keeps gold, what gives gold its monetary role is not the fact that the stockpile is not increasing. It's specifically the fact that it's not decreasing. As long as the stockpile is not being decreasing, is not being decreased because gold is not being consumed, then the stock to flow ratio is rising and the monetary nature of the good continues to increase. But when you start utilizing gold in industrial uses, when you start using it for things other than monetary uses, you're effectively eating into the stockpile. You're effectively making it less and less monetary and effectively making it more and more of an industrial good. And that's where the stock to flow begins to decline. And that's what takes away its monetary role.
Which is completely opposite to what mainstream economists or market analysts would have us believe, right? The usual narrative is, as there is more, a greater need in industrial usage for gold, there will be a greater demand for gold. Therefore, the price of gold will go up. That, you know, it's, again, you know, logically thinking through like a Bitcoin lens just turns all of that narrative on its head. It's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, if this was the case, if a lot of silver bugs and gold bugs will tell you, well, you know, you can't build batteries or this or that without silver or gold and you need this. And if it was about industrial uses, then copper and nickel would be the monies of the world. It isn't. There's a reason that nobody uses copper and nickel as money anymore. Copper has been demonetized even before, many years before silver. And that reason is that the stock to flow is very low. The quantity of the good is constantly being consumed in industrial uses and being taken off from the liquid market. And therefore, there's no possibility for the monetization of this good. And this is really where it comes back to the silver squeeze story of why this is really an instructive lesson. There's no potential for a supply, for a market squeeze in silver in the long run. Every pump is going to dump afterward because the quantity of monetary energy that is stored in silver, to use Saylor terminology, Michael Saylor's terminology, the quantity of monetary energy that's stored in silver is constantly leaking because constantly silver is being used in industrial stuff. And therefore, the quantity of monetary energy is not large. And therefore, when this quantity rises, it's very trivial for the miners to bring enormous new quantities of silver onto the market and therefore manage to take back a big chunk of this monetary premium back into the miners. So always whatever happens, you know, all of these shit coins, really, they can't continue to hold a pump, because as their price pumps, it's very trivial for their producers to make more of them. It's very easy for silver miners to make more silver. All the silver that is being held, this is really what to think about it, the way to think about it. All the silver bullion and silver coins that are held by all the silver bugs in the world are worth the production of about 3 years of silver. So the miners can already make a third of it. So if you double the price, the miners are going to still add at least a third, more or less, next year to all of this bullion and coin. And then the recyclers are going to add more and more. And the more the price rises, the more they throw in. There's no limit to how much they can keep digging under the ground and finding more silver and dumping it on the market. And of course, silver bugs and silver shills have all kinds of stories about how there's actually a structural deficit in the market for so long. But of course, the price shows this is nonsense. There's no deficit. And the reason governments went off the silver standard is because they were printing much faster than silver was growing. But it doesn't mean that silver isn't growing. The supply is always growing. The value is always declining. It's dropping against gold all the time. And it's just becoming more and more abundant. You see it, you know, people don't really use jewelry, silver in jewelry anymore, because it's too cheap to be used in jewelry. Even people like the color of silver. Now you get gold, you have white gold that looks like silver, but is actually made out of gold, because people don't like silver. It rusts. There's also that. And of course, as a monetary medium, it's completely useless, because it's very, very cheap. And that's really the thing that, you know, if you wanted to buy significant quantities of silver, it requires significant storage. And so the notion that the world is going to run on a monetary standard where, you know, $1 million is going to require, I think it was 13 bars, each one of these silver good delivery gold bars. I forget the exact number, but it's a pretty large area. You need basically a small room to store $1 million of silver. And that's just extremely expensive. And of course, moving it around is extremely much more expensive. So it's conservatively 100 times more expensive than gold, but potentially even more. Because it's by weight, it's very, you know, gold is 100 times more valuable. So this idea that you're going to just get enough monetary premium in people holding this for the price to rise, I think is foolish thinking. And, you know, the reason I don't like to shut up about it is because even though some of these people might think of themselves being motivated by sound money and wanting a free market and money and all of that stuff and, you know, let the market decide. No, the market is very clear. There's not going to be a way of restricting the supply of new silver onto the market. And so the people who are selling silver are going to benefit from selling it. And the people who enter late are going to end up holding giant bags of worthless rusting metal. And it's just another stupid shitcoin, really. At this point, pumping silver, I think, is kind of irresponsible given what's been happening with its price and given the dynamics of the market. And I think if you look at it in terms of the stock flow, it makes it very clear.
Can you even really genuinely think of silver as an inflation hedge? If those people that are looking to store silver, like that amount of silver that you're talking about, then they're the kind of people that would be using Michael Saylor's kind of metrics of 20-25% inflation.
Yeah. And so 20-25% inflation, silver is doing around 30% inflation. So if these numbers are correct at 30%, I could, you know, I'll accept that they're wrong. Obviously, there's a huge amount of uncertainty over all of these numbers because, you know, they don't have full nodes. It's primitive monetary technology where you're buying a part of something that whose supply you don't even know. But it's much cheaper to store gold, and gold is much more likely to hold on to its value. So I can understand the case for holding gold, but I see absolutely no case for holding silver. The cost of holding it is enormous. The fact that it's stock to flow means that the cost, it's likely to decline. And then the cost of moving it around is really insane. Like if you wanted to hold any, somebody sent me a message actually on Instagram. They told me they saw my tweet on Twitter, and They told me, in my tweet, I mentioned $1 million in silver, how much volume it would take. It would need basically a small room to keep it in. And he told me he had $100,000 stored in silver, and they had to move a house once. And it was, and he tells me how much of an ordeal it was. It was an entire day's work to move $100,000 of silver from one basement to another. And he tells me, you're absolutely correct about this. It's insane. If you think about it, when you start putting in serious amounts of money, it's extremely immobile. It's extremely heavy and extremely cheap. Therefore, you need to carry very large, very heavy quantities to move it around. So if you think about it this way, I can't see people holding it in real quantities, in real large quantities. You know, nobody who's got millions of dollars is going, well, obviously many people will, but not a lot of people who have millions of dollars are going to be buying millions of dollars of silver and going through the pain of holding them. To emphasize this point on stock to flow, one of my favorite examples is three other metals that have been discovered that are also indestructible, like gold. But they have failed to command any kind of real monetary premium. Some people dump them on investors, telling them this is the next gold, just like they dump shitcoins, telling them this is the next Bitcoin. These are platinum, palladium, and iridium. These three metals have been have only been discovered recently. And they have, and this is here, I'm sharing the lectures from Economics 12. From Economics 21, from the Bitcoin Standard, Lecture 2 in Economics 12, Bitcoin Standard. If you're registered for the courses on the website on safedean.com, you can access all my courses and see the class notes. This one is Lecture 2 in the Bitcoin Standard Economics 21 course. And if you're not registered, do register. You know, lots of courses and good Austrian economics material to chew over. So in this course, I go over the discussion of the stock to flow, and then I explain why with gold, what gives it its monetary role is not so much its rarity in this crust of the earth, in as much as it is the fact that it is indestructible and we have had a very large stock accumulate. And this is something that platinum, palladium, and iridium cannot recreate, because they only were discovered in the 1800s or so. And therefore, all the production that we can make of them is relatively large compared to the stockpile, because we've never had a very large amount of stockpile of them piled up, as we do with gold, because with gold, we've been mining gold for thousands of years, and that gold has been accumulating basically for thousands of years. So if you look at these, platinum, for instance, is a very good example, because in the 1800s, in the early 1800s, people discovered and started producing platinum. Its stockpiles were pretty small when the Russians decided in the 1820s to produce a platinum-based ruble. They decided, well, platinum is like gold, and it doesn't rust and it doesn't ruin like gold. So it's shiny like gold, and it glitters like gold. So, you know, as we know, all that glitters is gold. And therefore, let's base our ruble on platinum. And so they introduced this in the 1820s, but it was discontinued by the 1840s. And I think, as I explained in the notes, they misunderstood the value proposition of gold as being gold's rarity, and so assumed that platinum being rarer would be a better money. But the value of platinum fell on the global markets as new technology began to be employed in its production, allowing increasing new production. So even if these metals are indestructible, they do not have the many thousands of years of history of production behind them that gold has, which makes their stockpiles much larger than any new flows. And that's ultimately why trying to monetize those things is futile. We are not producing them in very large quantities because we don't use them as money, so we only use them industrially. If people started to buy them for very large quantities in order to make them into money, as the Russians were doing in the 1820s when they were buying platinum and minting it into coins, yes, it's going to raise the value of platinum on the market. The price of platinum is going to rise, but then what's going to happen? Platinum miner go brrr, and a lot of more platinum comes on the market. There's going to be a lot more platinum. And since there's only a small stockpile gathered over time, it's going to more or less, the stock to flow will decline because the new production is going to be very large compared to the stockpile. So This has prevented platinum and palladium from ever rising in terms of the amount of monetary energy that's stored in them. And if you look at the data for their stock to flow at this point, it's closer to one for both metals, depends on the data. And it's not very reliable data for them, but it's pretty clear that the amount of production every year is equal to the global stockpiles because most of the current production gets used in industry. These metals get used in highly sophisticated electronics and in machines and in all kinds of things. And so effectively, we're putting it back in Earth. We're digging it back in when we utilize it in industrial uses. And so the total amount of monetary value stored in platinum and palladium today is enormously insignificant. Very few people hold bars of palladium and platinum. And if they were to do it, as the Russians had done in the 1820s, and if people tried to monetize it, we're just going to end up with another story like the Hunt brothers, because there isn't a lot of stockpiles of liquid palladium or platinum on the market, and the miners are going to dump large quantities of it on the market, and it's going to come crashing down. So again, the dynamic with metals and gold is very similar to Bitcoin and shitcoins. You hear the same justifications for shitcoins as you would hear for metals. And speaking of shitcoins, the latest kid on the block, this social media influencer by the name of Elon Musk. He's some kind of Twitter influencer, I think. I'm not sure what exactly he does. Oh, no, I am sure. He's got this recipient of, he runs a corporation that basically trades carbon credits and loses money making cars in order to make money on carbon credits. This guy has been pumping this new coin, and obviously, you know, just like any other shitcoiner, they're very enthusiastic about their economic ignorance and presenting this information. So let's take a closer look at this shitcoin and analyze it from the perspective of its stock to flow. If we look at Dogecoin or Dogecoin, whatever the fuck they call it, the circulating supply is currently at 128 billion, which is, you know, a lot of doges. But obviously, as we know, the total supply of money does not matter. What actually matters is the growth rate. And so let's try and find out what's the growth rate for this shitcoin. So looking at their Wikipedia page tells us, Dogecoin started its initial coin production schedule with 100 billion coins in circulation. By mid-2015, the 100 billionth Dogecoin had been mined. And so, you know, they ran out of new production by mid-2015. And so their stock to flow had reached infinity by mid-2015. So they'd actually, you know, they didn't really have a plan for it. So they ran out. They said, we're going to have 100 billion coins. And then they mined all of these because their difficulty adjustment is clearly stupid, no matter how they're running it. So they ran it, and then these coins, so they started making more. So they decided, all right, 100 billion is clearly not enough. We need more coins. And so they started adding 5 billion coins every year. And so that's why we're at that level right now. There's currently no implemented hard cap on the total supply of Doge coins. Initially, Doge coin had a supply limit of 100 billion coins, which would already have been far more coins than the top digital currencies were allowing. As you see, their Wikipedia is run by economic ignoramuses because they think the total number matters, and they're quite happy that they have 100 billion, which is much more than all the others. Nonetheless, in February 2014, Dogecoin founder announced that the limit would be removed in an effort to create a consistent reduction of its inflation rate over time. And so now what they're doing is 5 billion a year forever, which actually, if you think about it, is not that inflationary, because as the, you know, the supply, the flow is constant and the stockpile continues to increase. So then effectively, eventually the stock to flow goes to zero. But this is still a shitcoin, even though, so currently if we look at its current supply, so this year started off with 128, so 5 billion over 128 is around, I'd say 4% or something like that. That's 4% annual growth, about 4% annual growth. So it's not that high. it's a little higher than Bitcoin, but it's not that high. It's not terrible. But of course, the problem with stupid shitcoins like Dogecoin is that there is absolutely no guarantee for the supply to remain at what it is. They've already changed the supply once, and it's quite easy to manipulate the currency and change the supply again. And if this thing does indeed become a popular thing and it does catch on, it doesn't matter how, eventually they're going to be getting into problems of monetary policy and who gets to decide on monetary policy. And eventually they're going to have probably compromises about their supply or changes for their supply. It's trivial for any shitcoin to be compromised because none of them has the track record of Bitcoin in terms of resisting change. Nobody ever got to change any of the important fundamental properties of Bitcoin in this regard. And so ultimately, there's a limit to how much idiots exist who are willing to trust part of their wealth in a currency whose supply is arbitrary. And ultimately, you know, no matter how far it goes up, it's going to go down because more and more coins are going to continue to be made. And they need an increasing number of people to continue to buy in order for the coins to continue to hold value. So eventually that's not going to hold, and eventually it's going to crash. And eventually all these stupid influencers pumping those stupid shit coins are going to be made to look very, very, very stupid. It's pretty absurd when you think about it. You know, he's got 45 million followers or something on Twitter. You know, a lot of these people idolize this guy. So a lot of them are actually going to pay attention to this scam coin, which is up and in an ungodly percentage over the last few days. So it's tempting to think that, well, Bitcoin can go up and can keep pumping. So then why can't we pump any of the other coins? And of course, if you've got a cult of personality around you, then you can see how you'd want to be the one in charge and the one pumping a coin that is different from the one that everybody else is using. So good luck to all of the people who are going to strap on this shitcoin rocket. We know how it ends up. Daniel?
Yeah, I just want to say something on this as well, mate. It just pisses me off what he's doing. It's just so freaking annoying. And it just undermines everything that people like yourself have already done in this space. You know, your books, other people that are in this space that are trying their best to educate people about, you know, Bitcoin and what Bitcoin is. And just to have someone come in and just like act this recklessly is really kind of undermining all the hard work that many of us have been putting in for the last couple of years. So it's just really fucking annoying and not well played at all. I'm sure Elon would never hear this, but you know, if he ever does, like, just cut the shit. And it's a point I made the other day as well on a different show. It's like that these shitcoins, they need influencers, whereas Bitcoin has educators. And that is such a fundamental difference between Bitcoin and anything else. So if anyone is, you know, just check who you're following, right? And if it's an influencer, it's almost certainly, well, we know it's a shitcoin. If it's an educator, it's Bitcoin. And I just like to point that out and hear your thoughts about that as well, because it certainly cheapens everything that so many people have put in place, all the authors and whoever else, the content creators that are trying to help people understand Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I tweeted about him earlier today, and that it's quite a damning indictment of fiat that this is, this is what it takes to be the richest man in fiat. I think, you know, under the gold standard, the elites, the people who were the richest people in the world, would definitely have not been doing something so crazy. You know, you think about Rockefeller, for instance. In order to become the richest man in the world, he invented modern oil. And of course, it's very fashionable for the same kind of people who pump stupid shitcoins like Dogecoin to hate on oil because it emits small particulates into the atmosphere. But none of these people have tried living 1 year without oil products. And if they have, they would be highly unlikely to survive it. The fact of the matter is our world is highly dependent. Our modern survival and civilization is highly, highly dependent on oil. not because of an evil conspiracy, but because oil is nature's perfect cheap battery. People are always fantasizing about creating new battery technology, and the batteries are there. They're called gas canisters, they're called gasoline tanks. These things are nature's most amazing batteries. They're dirt cheap. You can move them anywhere, and you can have enormous amounts of power on demand 24/7 from these things. This revolution really gave us the modern world. It gave us the expectation of surviving winter as a given, rather than as an ordeal that required you to spend your summer gathering wood and hoping that your roof holds up to the that your ceiling holds up to the storms. It's made modern homes safe, and it's made it's given us all the things, you know. And we've had an episode here before where we hosted Alex Epstein. I highly recommend it. He makes the moral case for fossil fuels. You know, this is what it took to be the richest man in the world 100 years ago. You had to revolutionize the world's technology for 100 years further. And you know, I'm going to piss off a lot of people here who like Elon Musk, but Elon Musk has made a car which is you know, it's still far less than 1% of all the world's cars. So he's still not cracked 1% of the world's car market, and he's not yet managed to turn a single profitable quarter without subsidies and carbon trading. Essentially, the car business is losing money, and he makes his money from carbon trading, which is a big, gigantic scam. And of course, the hilarious thing about it is that he uses the money from the carbon trading to finance his car company and to finance his space exploration company. So the end result is that you have rich people driving cars that are subsidized by people who drive gasoline cars, because they have to buy credit indulgences from the carbon indulgences from the Church of Carbon. Mm-hmm. And these indulgences are handed to Elon Musk so that he could then give people all these cars that require enormous amounts of fossil fuel energy to produce. You know, the notion that we could have a Tesla car without fossil fuels is ridiculous. It's an entirely, cars like that are entirely dependent on enormous amounts of fossil fuels for all manners of, for the entire production process, from the mining of rare metals all the way to the transportation of the metals, all the way to the production of the battery, and all of those things entirely reliant on fossil fuels. And yet presents it as an alternative to fossil fuels, and then takes all of these takes all of that money, invested in a space company which blows up rockets all over the world, and each one of those rockets probably emits more carbon dioxide than all of the cars of the world, or at least the cars of the US during the time of its flight. If you think about it, you know, I haven't run the numbers, but if you were to calculate how much carbon dioxide emissions those things make, I'm going to go ahead and take a wild guess and say that his rockets do not run on solar energy. I think it would not be very feasible to make all of these explosions on solar or wind. I don't quite see wind turbines powering all of these rockets. I'm guessing it's high-grade jet fuel that blows up. So it's pretty amazing that he's made a business out of selling carbon credits to apparently reduce the amount of carbon emissions. But ultimately, his cars probably make much more emissions in terms of production than regular gasoline cars, because, you know, you look at regular gasoline cars, they can be made so cheaply at this point. You know, you can buy cars for a few hundred dollars in parts of the world, new cars that are being rolled out for a few hundred dollars, because that technology is enormously cheap. And Tesla cars cannot be sold for $30,000 without government subsidies and carbon scam credit indulgences. So the notion that this is the future, that this is going to eat the fossil fuel car, I think is ridiculous. And you know, usually I've always held this opinion, and there's no amount of pumping of the Tesla stock that can change this. What would really change my mind on this is to see electric cars succeeding in the market, eating a very large share of the market without subsidies. So if we get to a point where we see electric cars exceed 10% of cars on the road, and they are not receiving favorable subsidies from governments, I will admit I'm wrong. Until then, it doesn't matter how much you pump the stock of your carbon credit trading company, you're just another shitcoiner. I'm sorry. Pumping Doge coin is really, in my mind, it's the cherry on top for what a fiat mind looks like. In that, you know, he's produced. He talks about colonizing Mars, and he talks a big game about all kinds of things, and his car company still can't operate without subsidies and carbon credits. And he falls for stupid shitcoin scams. You know, John D. Rockefeller changed the world, and I promise you, he would not fall for a stupid shitcoin scam like Dogecoin. So, yeah, he's not thought about this from the perspective of the stock to flow, clearly. We'll see. We'll see. Maybe he's right. Maybe he's the genius, and maybe Dogecoin is the future. Because, you know, he made an interesting argument today. He said that, you know, Bitcoin is deflationary to a fault, whereas Dogecoin is has declining inflation. So maybe he's right. Maybe we will live in a future of electric cars and Dogecoins on Mars. Maybe I'm an idiot and we will have that happen. So we'll see. And so on that note, I guess that's a good place to wrap it up now. Thank you so much, guys, for joining us. And thank you for all your questions, and I will see you on Thursday for the next seminar. Take care.